Okay, so like I said, what I want to do today is try and pull things together. You know, look at the whole story that we've been covering in the course of the quarter so far, from the outbreak of the First World War in 1914 to America's entry in the Second World War in December of 1941. And ask, what's to be taken away? What are the main points that we should draw from a study of that whole period? And you know how we've defined the issue that lies at the heart of this whole field of inquiry. Really a kind of a cluster of interrelated issues. The fundamental issue has to do with this phenomenon of war, great power war. And obviously of absolutely extraordinary historical importance, great power conflict. It doesn't even necessarily develop into a war like a Cold War. How is this to be understood? You know, how can you make sense of it? Is there anything of a general nature you could say about that kind of question? Because if you could understand something basic about the causes of war, well, then maybe you could also get some insight into the question of how we could have a peaceful world, a more stable order. And it tells you something, if you get insight in that question, what makes for war, tells you something about these basic issues of policy. How should policy be conducted? If you care about avoiding war, if you care about constructing a stable international system, what's the way to go? What's the way to go? And we got at that issue not by trying to develop it from first principles and deductive way, but rather by looking at what other people say and reacting to their arguments, including the kind of basic understanding of this question that you find in the world around you. A lot of people think, want to understand a war, you got to figure out who's to blame for it. Right? You want to understand what causes a war, you want to figure out who to point the finger at, because war is not the natural it's not natural to the system, not the natural product of the way the international system works. War is caused by aggression. You know, people start wars. They start wars because they're aggressive and want to change the status quo. And there are, like one of the big questions here is that correct? Is that common view of what makes for war? Is it capture what really went on in the past? Is that how we can understand the coming of the First World War, the Second World War in Europe in 1939, the war in the Pacific in 1941, and then eventually the second half of the course of the Cold War? Is it simply a question of good guys versus bad guys? You know, who to point the finger at? And it's important to realize that there are alternatives to that point of view. I mean, one of the most common alternatives is, oh no, you can have a war even though no one wants it, because statesmen can be overwhelmed by the workings of the military system that are in place at the time. And you want an example of this? You look at July 1914, the coming of the First World War during the July crisis of 1914. No one wanted a war, but statesmen had no choice. They were overwhelmed by these forces welling up from within the military sphere. So you can look at those arguments. These arguments about the rigidity of the war plans that is supposedly the cause of the war, the cult of the offensive, the interacting mobilization schedules. And, you look at these things in terms of the evidence. You flesh them out. Look at them, both in terms of their internal logic, but also especially in terms of the evidence. It turns out, at least this is the conclusion that I reach, that those arguments just don't stand up. Don't stand up in the light of the evidence. No. This was not a case of countries, the political leadership being overwhelmed by these forces. There were conscious, deliberate decisions that were made. Now you may say, well, there are only two choices. Either statesmen deliberately decide to start a war, or it happens because forces are unleashed that are beyond their control. It's not deliberate. You may think, well, those are the only two alternatives. But in fact, there's a third way of looking at these things. And this is the idea that war could be the product of a process where one thing leads to another. And you don't really need an aggressor to start a war, but people make decisions that you could maybe even to a certain extent sympathize with, decisions on all sides. And those decisions shape a process that has a certain momentum to it that leads to an armed conflict. And there's a logic to that process. There's kind of a plot to the story. And the logic has a lot to do with considerations of power. That's the thread that you look at when you're trying to make sense of what's going on. Okay. But there are limits to how far you can take that approach. The approach based on power, the approach that assumes that countries behave rationally in power political terms. It's theory, a theory of that sort, it doesn't necessarily give you the answers to the question of how things work. But it gives you something to go on as a point of departure for making sense of the story. And a lot of times, that conceptual framework falls short. And you see it falling short during the First World War itself. Because here you have, the two sides, they're locked in this military stalemate. It becomes clear quite rapidly that neither side is going to be able to defeat the other side quickly. And so you think it's a military stalemate that reveals important information. It reveals the information that the two sides are of approximately equal power. And therefore, instead of looking toward an outcome where one side totally defeats the other and imposes its terms on the other, you should look toward a compromise peace, a negotiated peace, something where neither side totally wins. Now there are two points to be made about this. Number one is that insight, it doesn't provide you with any understanding of what actually happened because there was no compromise peace in the First World War. That conceptual framework doesn't answer the question of what happened, but it defines the problem. Well, if this is the theoretical expectation that there should have been a compromise peace, a negotiated peace, why don't you have it? And framing the question in that way is a springboard for trying for reaching conclusions about why things developed the way they did. And I talked about this in the lecture on the First World War. There were reasons why these countries did not behave in what we would view as a rational way, rational and powerful. But there's another point to be noted, and that's that this area of study has an important normative dimension. It's concerned with issues of policy, with issues of the way things should be, the kinds of policies states should adopt. There was something very wrong with the sorts of policies that were pursued during the period of the First World War. There were alternatives that would have been a lot better. See, where do you find that kind of argument coming right to the surface? Well, it was in that Kennan piece you read at the beginning of the course. This lecture Kennan gave in 1950 about American entry into the First World War. And it's a very strong normative dimension there. He says, there was an alternative to the policy that Wilson pursued. Instead of making such a big fuss about America's neutral rights and so on, we should have thought about the real issues at stake here, which was what sort of world you're going to be living, you want to be living in, whether what America's fundamental interests were. America had an interest in a balance of power in Europe, where no single country would dominate all of Europe. And it should have been American policy to bring about a resolution of the conflict that restored a balance of power in Europe, instead of, you know, just getting all upset because the Germans were sinking some of our ships and taking revenge on the Germans for sinking some of our ships. That's childish. That's not the way policy should be conducted. And Cannon has that, you know, wonderful metaphor comparing American policy of that period to prehistoric dinosaur that, you know, you just have to whack him in the head, you know, to get him to pay attention to the fact that his interests are being threatened. And then he just thrashes about wildly and destroys everything in the process. You know, a very sharp critique of the Wilson policy. Excessively moralistic, excessively ideological. It screwed things up because it failed to take parapolitical realities into account, failed to think in terms of the balance of power. And so you look at that Cannon argument, and you have to say, is he right about this stuff? Same sort of issue came up when we talked about the Paris Peace Conference and the Treaty of Versailles at the end of the First World War, 1919. These moral issues, these issues of policy, what policy ought to be, policy should be, their center stage in the analysis of the Paris Peace Conference. Paris, the peace that was fashioned in 1919, the Treaty of Versailles with Germany especially, great power politics. And the only major peace settlement to be dictated by the Western democracies and by them alone. So you have to ask yourself, isn't there a connection between those two facts? You know, isn't there something wrong with the kind of foreign policies that you associated with democracies? Policies based on moral principle and self-determination, on ideas of justice and so on, as opposed to the power political approach, which were amoral. They're not concerned with punishing the aggressors so much as building a stable structure of power in the world. Okay? And so we got at that question by looking at different historical interpretations in the light of the evidence. Defenders of the Wilsonian approach to policy in general view the events of 1919 as marking Wilson's failure to achieve his peace program. Other people who are less sympathetic to Wilson take a very different view. Who's right? And what was just so striking there is that contrary to what we had all been led to believe, like in high school, is that Wilson was not the champion of a peace of reconciliation with Germany. He was not taking up the cudgels on behalf of a moderate peace with Germany. He was a moralist. He felt that Germany had clearly caused the war. It followed from that Germany should be punished for her crimes, and he would use terms like that. Yes, to be sure, before the United States came into the war, in January 1917, Wilson had given the speech, the Peace Without Victory speech, calling for a compromise peace. But as soon as the United States came into the war, the whole policy shifted practically overnight. These people attacked us. They forced us into war. Therefore, they're a criminal nation, because otherwise we wouldn't be at war, because we only go to war for moral reasons when the issues of right and wrong are so clear-cut. And if the other side has been revealed as a criminal nation now, well, then they're going to obviously have to be crushed and punished after the war was over. It says all this. All this has been kind of airbrushed out of the standard historical interpretations that people have latched onto, but it's right there. All you have to do is look at the evidence. There was this problem with the Wilsonian approach. On the one hand, The Germans should be subjected to a generation of thoughtfulness. They should be kept down for 20, 30 years, not given the same political rights as the victor countries. You know, during that period, they should repent. They should make penance, you know, make amends for the crimes that they had caused. Of course, they're going to accept our view of these things because our views are not idiosyncratic or parochial in any way. Because we have a direct pipeline to the absolute truth. And this is these are these notions America, you know, stands above the rest of the world. So you have a peace based on the idea that the Germans had caused the war and they should be kept down as a result of that. And in particular, that they should not be allowed to build up their power to whatever level they wanted, the way the Allies would be allowed to. On the other hand, if the Germans resisted, Wilson was against the idea of the use of force against them, of enforcing the treaty. So the French brought up this idea, you know, Wilson condemned them and said, even if you associate the use of force with the League of Nations, what that would do is simply substitute international militarism for national militarism. Militarism is bad, the use of force, when the moral issues were not absolutely clear-cut, was bad. You should only use force when you yourself are attacked, et cetera, et cetera. That meant that, on the one hand, the Germans, and on the other hand, you were saying that you weren't going to enforce the treaty in the event that they did resist. You know, what could be worse in terms of the effect on international stability? And when the Germans did resist, you had this problem of reconciling the two halves of the liberal program, the whole idea of justice and punishing the aggressor on the one hand, with the idea of non-use of force on the other. So views changed very rapidly in the winter of 1919-1920. The famous book by John Maynard Keynes, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, was a big part of this story. But basically, there was this dramatic shift in the notion that, since force was out of the question, we had to kind of change our basic approach to peacemaking and reach for reconciliation with Germany, and that meant just a dramatic alteration. So if the French were interested in enforcing the peace, and the French said, if we don't enforce this thing, the whole system will collapse and Germany will once again reemerge as the dominant power in Europe, France was not supported by the Americans or even by the British. Right? The shift in American policy took us of a vote in the Senate, this is a refusal of the Senate to ratify the Covenant of the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles. Wouldn't have made any difference if the United States had gone into the League of Nations. The crucial thing was the policy that was pursued, a policy now of non-enforcement of the treaty supplemented by, you know, a change in the basic philosophy of dealing with Germany, reaching out toward the common nation. So the French were isolated. They felt abandoned by their Anglo-Saxon allies because the British were changing the same way. What were they to do? Their great hope had been to maintain the wartime alliance because the bloc of the three great Western democracies was a lot stronger than Germany. As long as there was solidarity between France and Britain and the United States, in particular if there were British and American troops on French territory, then the French could be relatively relaxed about their relations with Germany, easing up on the But if they were abandoned by the Anglo-Saxons, and if the British and the Americans were essentially turning their back on involvement in Europe, then the problem was very acute for France. What were they to do? Just walk away from the treaty and allow Germany to be the strongest country in Europe again? Stronger even than she had been relative to the other countries in Europe in 1914, because there's no counterweight to Germany in the East anymore. France walks away from the treaty. What was the point of fighting the war? What was the point of sacrificing an entire generation of young Frenchmen to achieve this victory? On the other hand, how are you going to enforce the treaty? If you tried to enforce the treaty, ultimately it would be alienating Britain and America, the countries that in the long run you might want to count on to come to your aid in the event that there was a new German threat. So So it was hard for the French. And year after year, they kind of put off the decision until finally by the beginning of 1923, it could be put off no longer. So you have this conflict over the treaty, over the whole question of German power. Would Germany once again reemerge as the dominant power in Europe? Or would France be able to kind of contain Germany? That conflict over the treaty, because the Versailles system is a set of constraints on German power, keeping the Germans down. Crucial things are the disarmament clauses and the demilitarized status of the Rhineland. Germany's being kept down in that way. Which way would France go? They had tried to avoid the real test of strength, but the Germans had focused in resisting the treaty. They had focused on its most vulnerable point, the point that was technically most difficult to enforce: the reparations. So although the reparations issue lay at the heart of great power politics in the early post-Versailles period, it was not because the money was so important in and of itself. It was the whole Versailles system, the question of power in Europe, that was at stake. And so finally the French accepted the test of strength. And in fact, it seemed by August of 1923 that the French had won it. Defeat from the jaws of victory by not telling the Germans exactly what the Germans would have to do. The French are now, by late 23, are reaching for a policy of seeing German unity collapse. It doesn't work. They don't want to actually even follow through with it all the way. And they basically turn to Britain and America to bail them out. And the terms are, you can't use force like that again against Germany. And they accept those terms. So ultimately, France loses the test of strength. But it wasn't a victory for the Germans either, because the Germans could not pursue a policy of direct resistance, headlong resistance against the Versailles system, because they too were dependent on the import of capital from Britain, and especially from this period. So German freedom of action is constrained. They never changed their basic goal, throwing off the shackles of Versailles, reemerging as the number one power in Europe. Dramatic changes in the status quo. You see the Stresemann policy of the late 1920s. German annexation of Austria. German annexation of the German-speaking areas. The fringe of Czechoslovakia. The re-annexation of the areas that had been lost to Poland in 1919, and ultimately even the re-annexation of Alsace-Lorraine. This is not the policy of a good European, although it was packaged in that way, because the Germans didn't want to kind of resist the peace settlement head-on. They pursued a more indirect strategy. The German term there was Finanzierung. That's the Stresemann policy. Very important to understand what the Stresemann policy was. It was not a policy of, let's let bygones be bygones, we accept the status quo, let's deal with each other in peace. Stresemann's policy was not the policy that the West German government pursued after 1945. No way. Why the difference? Is it because the Versailles peace was so harsh? No. The terms that were imposed on Germany after World War II were much, much harsher. But whereas the Germans had no chance of resisting the arrangements that were imposed after World War II, after World War I, it was a totally different story. Power realities made it plausible that Germany could successfully pursue a policy of resistance. And there's no doubt the Stresemann policy was a policy of resistance. They played a certain game, telling the Allies what they wanted to hear. Went along, you know, with the whole Locarno policy, the whole vision of we buried the hatchet, we invented a new era of peace, and so on, with the argument that that being the case, you got to get rid of all of the discriminations that were built into the treaty. They go along with this, but the Allies increasingly are under no illusions. about what German policy was, or about whether the German people had essentially been reconciled in a common movement. Right? It was clear that they were increasingly dissatisfied with the current arrangements. But the Allies, Britain, France, felt they had no choice. Having embarked on this policy, they couldn't return to a policy of force. And so, hoping against hope that things would work out in the end, they go from concession to concession. In the 1920s, this is. The removal of military control from Germany in 1927. The removal of the last occupying forces from the Rhineland in 1930, 5 years ahead of schedule. And finally, December 1932, a month before Hitler comes to power in Germany, the declaration granting Germany equality of rights in matters of armor. Germany can now arm up to whatever level she wants. Important to understand that these things happened before Hitler came to power, a lot of them before the Depression even struck. Another very important chronological point is that the French can see how things are developing, and they make the decision to opt for a defensive strategy to begin the construction of a line of fortifications along the Franco-German border, the Maginot Line, in 1929, again, before the Depression. It's not as though peace was taking root, and unfortunately there was this big economic problem that brought Hitler to power, and that messed everything up. There would have been a problem regardless. Basic problem was political. You could see the continuity between the 1920s and 1930s. Very important conclusion here. I like to think, oh, well, Germany's a democracy. Weimar Germany advanced this democracy for that period, a welfare state kind of. And yet the problem remains intact. Okay. Is this to argue that the coming to power of Hitler made no difference? Well, of course not. And it obviously made a huge difference. To say that there are continuities is not the same as saying that there were no differences. When Hitler comes to power, the pace quickens. Germany's goals become much more far-reaching than they had ever been under Schleswig. To be sure, during the initial period, the Nazi policy is quite cautious because they're worried that the mere presence of Hitler at the head of the German state would trigger an Allied military intervention against Germany. Now, rationally, the Allies should have launched a preventive war against Germany. That's what the German propaganda minister, Goebbels, thought at the time. They want to take care that that sort of thing doesn't happen, that Germany makes its way through the danger zone while it's rearming. And so they pursue all these bilateral agreements, the agreement with the papacy, Hitler's speeches condemning war, and all these kinds of things, until they're ready to take a stronger line. And the moment for a stronger line comes in March of 1936, when the Germans, violation not just of Versailles, but of Locarno as well, remilitarized the Rhineland. And Western powers basically do nothing. This changes the whole strategic situation because it makes Germany ultimately less vulnerable to pressure on her Western border and gives Germany greater freedom to put pressure on her eastern borders to change the status quo there. And sure enough, a couple of years later, you find the Anschluss with Austria, Czech crisis culminating in the Munich Conference in 1938. Remember that Hitler viewed Munich not as a success, but as a defeat. He wanted a little war with the Czechs. His goal had been to isolate Czechoslovakia. And in fact, he had drawn back under British pressure from the terms that he had wanted to impose on Chamberlain at the Godesberg Conference. Right? This in high German circles was a source of amazement that the Fuhrer had actually pulled back from the Great War. But Hitler didn't want a war with the Western powers at that point. He thought a war with them was inevitable, that they would never simply sit on their hands and give Germany what Germany wanted, a free hand to change the status quo in the East. But he wanted to put her off to the 43-45 period. And during the intermediate years, he wanted to build up German strength, not least by acquiring new territories in the East at the expense of, you know, Germany's eastern neighbors. The Munich Agreement did not lead to détente between Germany and the Western powers. German demands, German discourse remained very strident, and the British were coming to think that if Hitler remained in power, a showdown between Germany and the Western powers was inevitable, maybe before the end of the year 1939. Hitler, for his, yes? At the end of 1938, November of 1938, Czech crisis basically peaks in October 1938 and November of 1938. Oh, you're stretching, okay. Well, within a particular year, if there are more than, if there's the Austrian crisis and then the Czech crisis, it's important that you know that the Austrian crisis precedes the Czech crisis. You don't have to know the precise month, but you just have to know the order. Because in some of these years, that you have more than one important development. Okay, and Hitler becomes, you know, less concerned for reactions of people in the West, yeah? Well, it's like, in a sense, what do we even mean by it being dead? In a sense, it's dead as soon as the Allies decide that they're not going to use force against Germany. 1923, maybe? You know, it's don't get too concerned with the words. The point is that, you know, there's no way that the West is going to block the rise of German power, and German power is on the upswing during this whole period. The important event takes place in March of 1939. Everyone should know about this. The German seizure of Rump, Czechoslovakia. The German seizure of Prague. This is evidence of the new brutality. The mask gets thrown off. It's no longer just ethnic Germans that are the target of Hitler's policy. Now he's taking over areas that are inhabited by non-ethnic Germans, an area, in fact, that had been guaranteed by the British. So he's basically thumbing his nose at the Western powers as well. He said in Munich that the Sudetenland was his last territorial claim in Europe. All he wanted to do was get ethnically German areas. Now he's being revealed as a liar. It's a dramatic change in feeling, especially in Britain, following Hitler's move into Prague in March of 1939. Right? The policy of appeasement is discredited pretty much overnight. Policy of standing up to the Nazis. This is what the British people want. Very important development. This is the development that marks the shift from a policy of appeasement to a policy of resistance. Hitler could scarcely believe it. He said, well, people can only scream for so long. This will pass. As soon as the British understand that there's nothing they could do to stop Germany, they'll accommodate to realities. And this does not mean that the shift in British opinion does not mean that Hitler puts his dynamic policy on hold. He continues with putting certain demands on Poland. The British, after Munich, give Poland a guarantee that they would come to Poland's aid in the event of the German invasion. But Hitler doesn't believe that the British are going to live up to that guarantee. Well, they had walked away from guarantees in the past. I've seen those worms at Munich, he says. And his demands against Poland become stronger and stronger as the Poles resist. And as the Polish crisis develops, the British and the French take a stronger line. Each side gets more and more involved in the crisis so that no one can really pull back. Hitler can't pull back. And he does whatever he can to deter the British from intervening. The key development here is the signing of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, amounting to a partition of Poland, in August of 1939. Now the Nazis and the Soviets are in effect allies. Britain has no hope of saving Poland now that Soviet military power can't be brought into play. Hitler thinks, well, they'll at the last minute, they'll realize that the situation in Poland is hopeless and they'll back off. But they don't back off. And he has no choice but to go to war with them. After Poland is invaded and Britain declares war, I told you, he turns to Ribbentrop and says, you know, after hearing the British declaration of war, what? And not the end of the story, the outbreak of the Second World War. You have these developments that lead up to December 1941, an American intervention in the war. The fall of France leads to a quickening of American involvement. Fall of France in June of 1940. The sense that America is getting increasingly involved, and Roosevelt wants to bring the country into the war, even though he has a lot of trouble doing it. This leads Hitler to think that he has to act sooner rather than later to clear the decks in his east. The America factor plays a crucial role in the timing of the German attack on the Soviet Union in June of 1941. And that, in turn, leads the Americans to say they have to get involved sooner rather than later. Roosevelt tries to provoke Hitler into declaring war against the United States by launching the naval war against Germany in the North Atlantic in late 1941. It doesn't work because Hitler refuses to take the bait. And that's where the whole Japanese thing comes into play. Not an accident that the very month after the German attack on the Soviet Union in June, the end of the next month, July of 1941, the Americans slapped the oil embargo on Japan. And we saw how the oil embargo put the United States and Japan on a collision course. You know, was this an accident? Roosevelt didn't know what he was doing. Policy seized by his subordinates and so on. No, those arguments don't stand up. It's a deliberate policy, and it achieved its goal. America and Japan were at war by the end of the year, and Germany, to the relief of people in the White House, declares war on the United States just 4 days later. The end of one story. December 1941, and the beginning of another. But that's the story that we're ending with before the midterm. After the midterm on Monday, I'll begin talking about the origins of the Cold War.